if it's getting too long, just like shut me up and it's gonna be fine. So why scale and conformal variance? But it's a question that's been around for about 25 years. And apart from the work by Polshinsky, almost nothing has been done on it until very recently. So I'm going to first talk about, like, just do a small historical review of basically what Polshinsky did and other people a bit later on. And then I'll go in the meat of the whole thing that we did. So first, we'll talk about scale and conformal variance in two dimensions. And there, the question that somebody can ask is, does scale and variance imply conformal variance? So Polshinsky, following Zamolchikov, showed that actually, if you have unitarity and finiteness of the energy momentum tensor correlation functions, then scale implies conformal invariance. And that's due to some conservation of the energy momentum tensor, so some Ward identities that you use there, then you can prove that. And there were some counterexamples, but I put quotes here because they're not really counterexamples, because they violate either one or the other of those two assumptions here. So the first one that was before actually Polshinsky was the nonlinear sigma model by Hall and Townsend. And what they showed is that you have a theory that is scaled, but not conformal invariance. But Polshinsky argues that you don't have finiteness of the energy momentum tensor correlation functions. So that violates basically the assumption. So that's fine here. The other example came up way later by Cardin and Riva in 2005. And it's the theory of elasticity. And what they showed that, OK, you get scaled without conformal invariance there too. But the problem is it's non-reflection positive. And elasticity is in two dimensions, not 1 plus 1, so it's Euclidean. And the reflection positivity is the equivalent of unitarity in Euclidean space, so you violate that assumption too. So what you get that scale invariance implies conformal invariance. There are, like, we've heard about other things that happened. We're not exactly sure if they're right or not, but there's some work that apparently say that in two dimensions you can have scale without conformal invariance without violating those two things, but I'm not going to talk about that. If you want to ask me, I can talk about it later after the talk. I'm not sure if they are wrong or not, because we heard about them maybe like 2 months ago or something, and we didn't have much time to study them because we'll see, we have some problems at the end, so we want to fix those first, and then we'll read the other papers carefully. But they might be right. I'm not sure of that. One thing that's interesting also, it's, yeah, I can tell you after if you want. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, what did you say?
Is it equivalent to saying that the scale
is not working? No, it's not equivalent to that. It really, the problem is nonlinear sigma models on the target space, and the target space is not compact. And then you cannot define the correlation functions carefully. So they're not well defined if you want, and that's a problem there. So there are no real scales that appear here.
But in the original condition, when you say finiteness of the tensor, basically amounts to say that the scale invariant regulator.
It's scale invariant what?
Regulator and normalized.
Yeah. Yeah, more or less, yeah. You can use like dimensional regularization or something like that, so you don't get the scale and everything's fine. Box phi squared? Yeah.
Yes, box phi squared.
Box phi and parentheses around the whole thing? Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to talk about those. Polshinsky has some like little arguments about those, but he talks about them a bit. There's one of, actually, I think it's something with 1 over 5 squared somewhere, so you get an interacting theory that is scaled but not conformal invariant, but then you don't really know what to do except when you expand around a VEV and then like you break everything. So yeah, but if you have a free theory, it's not that interesting either. Yeah. That's not what we want to do here. Okay, so now, you can ask the same question in dimensions larger than 2, so in 1 plus something larger than 1. And the question is, again, does scale imply conformal invariance? And there's no proof at Polshinsky. So Polshinsky showed that actually If you look at the water entities for the engine momentum tensor, you don't have enough information to do the same thing that you did in two dimensions, like Zamolodchikov did. So you cannot see that scale does imply conformal invariance. But the thing, the very interesting thing is that there are no interesting counterexamples. They are, but they are not that interesting. If you want, they're not exactly what we want to do. So the first examples we heard of are in ADS CFT, where you use a KRDS black hole. And the rotation of the black hole, it's in 5 and 7 dimensions. So rotation of the black hole actually spontaneously breaks the conformal invariance. So if you're on the background, breaks the conformal invariance, but not the scale invariance. So that's interesting, but we don't know what is the dual. And also, like, the problem is there's a big C here, which means CFT, which means conformal. And we'd like to have scale, but not conformal. So you don't want to break it spontaneously. You want just to start with scale and no conformal invariance. Another example is Maxwell theory, indeed different than 4 dimensions, but actually it should be larger than 4 here. And that's been studied by those two groups very recently. It's this year. But the problem with that is a free field theory. And if you introduce interactions, then the gauge coupling is dimension full, so you screw up everything, and you cannot do anything there, like you get dimension 1 coupling in 5 dimensions or whatever. So you break scale invariance directly by interactions. And what I would like to do is get a quantum field theory that's interacting that has scale but not conformal invariance. By that I mean not spontaneously broken. So we know that scale does not necessarily imply conformal invariance, but we don't have like counterexamples, so maybe there's a proof. And there are two ways of looking at that. Either like, okay, you don't have a counterexample, you can still look at what are the physical implications of scale without conformal invariance. So I'll start with that because actually there are a lot of things that people haven't checked in the last 25 years that are very interesting and will find very nice physics. And what's funny is it's quantum field theory, but nobody looked at it in all those years. And then also, like, if you get counterexamples, then what you can ask is, do you get a lot of examples of scale without conformal invariance? Because actually the conditions for scale invariance with, compared to conformal invariance are much weaker. So it's an uncharted territory. The physics is very nice, and I'll go through that here. And then I'll talk about possible examples, like how to get to examples. And because of that bit here, scheme dependence of beta functions, then we have problems in the examples for four-dimensional ones, and we're working on those right now. Either we'll get them. If we don't get them, then I'll believe in the A theorem. I'll explain later. But if we don't get them, then there's no A theorem. Or if you want, there's no naive A theorem. OK, so any questions up now? It's fine? OK. So I'll start with preliminaries. I'll explain a bunch of things, and then we'll go through the very nice physics that scale without conformal invariance imply. So, okay, everything would be related to Polshinsky because he's the one who did everything in 1988, and then nothing happened till 2011 mostly. Not exactly true, but whatever. So, what is the dilatation current? The dilatation current is given by this. Here, the T is any symmetric energy momentum tensor, and that bit, you can see it. Okay, dilatation is space-time symmetry, so that comes from the space-time nature of the transformation. And there's another part that we'll call the virial current because it's going to come very often. That's terminology coming from Coleman. And that bit contributes to the scale dimension of the fields. So here, since you can choose any energy momentum tensor, there's some freedom in the definition of the dilatation current. But that freedom is compensated by the virial current here. And now it's pretty easy to see if you want a conserved dilatation current. You need to have that trace of the energy momentum tensor has to be proportional to divergence of local current. Now, if you go to the conformal current instead, it's the most general one is something like this. Again, the T is the same than before, so it's any symmetric energy momentum tensor, and it's there because, again, because of the space-time nature of the conformal transformations. You have here another virial current, which is basically the previous one plus a conserved, like some of conserved currents, if you want. So that's the most general thing you get. And that one comes from the fact that, OK, I had ambiguity in the dilatation current, so I have to fix it for the conformal one. So if I chose one, then I have to fix it there. And then there's a last bit, which is another local symmetric operator. And this one corrects for the position dependence of the scale factor. And that thing is the scale factor. Vx is basically a quadratic function of the position. And when you decompose it carefully, you see the full Poincaré group, if you want, in there, with the conformal transformations. And again, like the freedom in the choice of the engine momentum tensor is compensated by the choice of the ferial current and also of that two-index symmetric local operator. So if you want conformal invariance in this case, you check, you take derivative of this, and then you check what you get, what you need to get that equal to zero. That means that this modified ferial current has to be equal to, the trace of the energy momentum tensor has to be equal to the divergence of that modified ferial current, which has to be equal to the double derivative of the two-index symmetric tensor. And what Porzhkinsky also showed is if you have conformal invariance, then you get this, but you can actually modify, if you want, improve the energy momentum tensor and get the traces in the energy momentum tensor. So there's a transformation that would take like the page, but I'm not going to write it there. It's in the paper by Porzhkinsky. So that means if you have conformal invariance, you can find an energy momentum tensor that's traceless. If you don't, and you just have scaled invariance, you'll have the trace of the energy momentum tensor is proportional to the divergence of a local operator. So that's basically what's summarized here. Scale invariance implies this. Conformal invariance implies this. So if you want scale without conformal invariance, what that means? That means that you need that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is the divergence of a local symmetry of a local operator, but that local operator must not be the sum of a conserved current here, like this, and the divergence of a two-index symmetric tensor. And from that, you see easily that you get constraints on the ferial current. And since the charge has to be Gange invariant, that means the spatial integral of it has to be Gange invariant. And since that has fixed the spacetime dimension, then that has to have fixed the minus one spacetime dimension. And Porzhkinsky pointed out again, if you have no suitable ferial current, then scale would imply conformal invariance. In models, for example, like this, where you just have one scalar field, and you go and let's say four minus epsilon with phi 4 theory here, then there's only one possible choice for the ferial current. It's going to be dimension 3, is phi d mu phi. But phi d mu phi is the same thing as 1 half d mu phi squared. And d mu phi squared is of this type here. So that's the end of it. You have conformal invariance. OK, so now, like I told you, what's the general thing? So we're going to look for what ferial current we need and what energy momentum tensor we should choose. And we'll try to build a dilatation current in a theory that is scaled but not conformal invariant. So we'll start with the simplest thing, start with the theory that is classically scale invariant. And I'll use dimensional visualization to normalize the whole thing. So I have my gauge fields here. And I have scalar fields and fermions. And the A, B, C, D indices, and A, B, C, D indices are in color and flavor space for the scalars, and I, J, K are in color and flavor for the fermion fields. And then I have the interactions, the only ones that are dimensionless, if you want, four dimensions. Classically, you have the quartic terms and then the Yukawa terms. So that's the most general thing you can start with. Actually, there's some mixings in the gauge fields, but I'm not going to be interested in that. I mean, just to make it simpler, I assume there's no mixing. So what is the choice for the real current? Well, the simplest choice is this. So that's dimension 3 here. That's dimension 3 here, classically. And then if you want this bit not to be the divergence of phi A, phi B, QAB has to be anti-symmetric. Otherwise, I can take the derivative outside, and then I get, again, conformal invariance. And this bit here, there's no derivative on it. That's fine. But you want that to be real because the ferial current is real. So that has to be anti-emission. So that's my most general ferial current I can have. You cannot put gauge fields there. If you try, the only one would be the U1 field, d nu f mu nu, if you want. But that's already d mu there, so it's conformal. And the other one would be a transimmune term, but also that's conserved. So nothing happens. And now, what's the best choice for the Angiomeriton tensor? It so happened that it is the new improved Angiomeriton tensor of Kahn, Coleman, Jack Heave. Why? Because this one is finite, and it's not renormalized. So that's the one that satisfies the, if you want, the general Ward identities. And it has an anomalous trace. And if you look at Robertson, for example, it's pretty easy to see actually why it's that, because the Angiomeriton tensor in 4 minus epsilon dimension will have an epsilon L in it. And there's a like D L, the Lagrangian, so you get epsilon there, and that's going to give you the trace here, the part that is anomalous with the epsilon. So you see it's basically the Lagrangian, but it's weighted by the beta functions and the anomalous dimension matrices here. So with this and that, we can start working. Yeah, and just like in 4 dimensions, just tell you, the beta functions will be given by this, obviously. I'm going to need them later. We'll see to compare. It's going to be interesting. OK. So if you look at the divergence of the rotation current, given by what I said at the very beginning, you introduce the, so it's x. Basically, it's just going to be the trace of the new improved Angiomeriton tensor. What you get is this. And if you want it to be conserved, that has to be equal to 0. But one important thing is that has to be equal to 0 up to the equation of motion. So I'm going to come back to that, because we got a bunch of questions. I can understand why we got the questions, but it's still textbook physics, so I don't really know like why people got so stuck on that. But I'm going to explain why. So if you want that to be equal to 0 to the equation of motion, so choose that beta function here to be of this form. Then the gammas will add to, by the q's will add to the gammas. And then that's going to go with this here. And I'm just going to get the equation of motion. So I get gamma plus q times the equation of motion. So I can drop that term. The only one I cannot do that is for the gauge field. So that one has to be at a fixed point if you want for the gauge coupling. And then you do the same thing for the fermions here. So to get a conserved dilatation current, you need something like this here. And that's what Polshinsky wrote in his paper in the simplest case of one scalar field. On the other hand, if you want a conserved conformal current, then you apply this on it, and then you check you want it equal to 0 up to the equation of motion. That implies that all the beta functions are equal to 0. And like one thing, we got the question, why can you use the equation of motion? Then if you ask me that, you have to say, why can you use the equation of motion for conformal field theory? So the people who ask us that, one thing I found weird is like they don't believe in conformal field theory, or they don't believe in using the equation of motion. And they don't believe in equation of using the equation of motion. So it's kind of two weird things. They tell us, oh, you cannot do that here. So your theory is not really scalar invariant. But then that means they cannot do that here, and that they don't believe in conformal field theory. Because to reach that, if you look at this here, put all the q's equal to zeros and all the beta equal to zeros, you get something that is proportional to the equation of motion. So you still have to use the equation of motion. So just a small slide about why you can use the equation of motion. Right, it's textbook physics, as I said. You can look in Peskin, but the best explanation we found is in Collins, because it also includes the anomaly part. So when you take a current and you look at this divergence, you get three contributions. One part is proportional to the equation of motion. One part is what would be the classical violation of the symmetry. And one part is the possible anomaly that you get there. Then if you plug the current inside like Green's function, and what you get, this bit gives you the expected contact terms from the Ward identity. The bit here leads to like the usual non-anomalous classical violation. So that would break the symmetry. But this one like doesn't, because it's just the expected contact terms you get from the Ward identity. And this one is the possible anomaly, so that would break the symmetry too. So let's look at a simple example, something like QCD. Let's say it's SU3 here and a bunch of fermions there with a mass term here. So if I define a vector current here and I chose the A index to be in the flavor group, I can even choose it to be in the gauge symmetry group, then you get the like a current here given by this. When you apply the derivative on it, you get two terms, one derivative on the first and then the other one derivative on the second. And when you write it, you can add a zero that includes the mass term, and then you get part of this equation of motion. And then you get this part here. It's going to be equal to 0 only when that commutes. And then the anomaly part is actually equal to 0 here. And you see this bit here, that commutes. if that commutes and it's equal to zero, and then I have a conserved current. So it's easy to see that if I take it in the symmetry group, and I take M to be diagonal, so I get a full SUN vector here. And you get just the usual symmetry. So there's no problem using the equation of motion. Actually, you have to use the equation of motion to show that a current is conserved. And now you can say, OK, in our case, you have the anomaly, like in the conformal case. So it's a bit tricky. That's true. But as I said, you can cancel it up to the equation of motion, so everything is fine, like in the conformal case. But one person asked us, if you use the equation of motion in the axial case, then you get zero, so there's a contradiction there. But that's not true. You don't actually get zero, because you have to define your current carefully using dimensional regularization. Here, if you want to define your axial current, you have to write it this way, because gamma 5 is not well defined in dimensions different than 4. So I have to define it carefully. I get this. Now, if I take the derivative on both and I use the equation of motion, the gamma mu and the gamma 5, they don't commute. So I have to be careful when I move it around. And I get this contribution here and this contribution there. And it so happened that for the U1 case, this bit is not zero. So that's not true that actually using the equation of motion for the axial current, you get zero. So with all that said, I think I hope I convinced you that you can use the equation of motion. OK. So we found how you get what kind of beta functions you need to get scaled but not conformal variants. Now you can say a bunch of things about it. So the new and improved energy momentum tensor is finite and normalized, as was shown originally by Kevin Coleman and Jack Heath. And as shown by Politzer and then Robertson, the operators related to equations of motions are also finite and not normalized. So that means that the real current is finite and not normalized. So it is a non-conserved current with scale dimension exactly 3. And if you compare with some unitary bounds you get in conformal field theories, you know that for a vector of dimension 3, it has to be conserved. You can look in this paper, that's what they get to. But if you look at scale invariants, then the only thing that implies is conserved current has to have dimension larger than 2. So here, that is against conformal invariants, but that's not against scale invariants. So that's consistent. So you reach that non-trivial real current implies non-conformal scale invariant quantum field theories. And by non-trivial, I mean it's not d mu v mu is not equal to 0. So now that we have the beta functions here, it's pretty easy to solve them. Because you look, it's linear in the couplings. So you can just solve. And what you get this. So there's beta function. You have RG trajectory. And you get that the gauge coupling doesn't change, obviously, but those, they change. And you just get multiplied by those matrices that are given here. And one thing you can check, which is pretty easy, is if you use the beta functions, you see they're homogeneous in the couplings. So once you plug that solution here in them, all the matrices, the z's here, they go in front, and then I still get a solution. So any point on the RG trajectory is a scale invariant point. So I won't get any dimensional transmutations here. If I were to get that, then I would get a scale, and then I would not get scale invariants. So I don't get that, and everything is self-consistent. One thing you can check also is the Q and the P will be constant along the RG trajectory, since those are like the beta functions are just first-order differential equations. If those were to change, then you would get crossings of the RG trajectory, so that's not consistent. So they have to be constant. And because this is anti-symmetric in that's entire emission, then this matrix is orthogonal. This one is unitary. That means that if I have a point where the beta function is non-vanishing, and that is the case on the scale invariant trajectory, because those Qs are not zero and those Ps are not zero, then that means that those won't change the norm of the beta function. So I always have a point where the beta function won't be equal to zero. So everything is consistent with a trajectory there. And now it's the very nice part of the physics. You get RG flows along scale invariant trajectories are actually recurrent behaviors. So that's something that people studied a long time ago and didn't think would happen. And if you can find an example, then you get recurrent behaviors. A very easy way to see that is look at the virial current. it generates a transformation in the symmetry group of the kinetic term. So the Q was anti-symmetric, and the P is anti-emission, so that generates a transformation in SON and in UN here. And also, those have Bernoulli measuring eigenvalues. So when you look at that here, the only thing you'll get is oscillations there. So the couplings will oscillate. And you have two possible choices here. Either you get limit cycles or quasi-periodic Scandrian trajectories. So basically, they're called ergodicity. That's going to happen if you look at the eigenvalues of those. And if you get two commensurate eigenvalues, then you can go from limit cycles to quasi-periodic behavior. OK, another way of saying that is if you look at the dilatation current, you have, again, let me write it again. You have this here, the scale, the space-time part of it, and then the extra part that gives you a new contribution to the scale dimensions of the fields. And you know that the RG flow is actually generated by the real scale transformation here. But the RG flow is related to the virial current through its conservation. And since the real current, as I said, generates internal transformation of the fields in the symmetry group of the kinetic term, and that symmetry group is actually compact, then it has to rotate back to or close to the identity. But that means that this bit here, since like I want this to be conserved, this bit also has to go back to or very close to the identity, and that I get recurrent behavior. So was not expected, but I guess when you think about it afterwards, since you don't want to get a dimensional transmutation and you just want a Scalarian trajectory, there's nothing else you can get. Now we got a bunch of questions about the flow. So I'm going to go through a series of arguments here at another point in the talk why it's we actually think it's flowing. I'm pretty sure it's flowing. I mean, I'm convinced it's flowing. If it doesn't flow, then there are big problems with something else. So I'm going to talk about that. The first one is RG flow is basically just a filler definition. So are you sure that it's a Scalarian trajectory or it's not a fixed point? And that's a legitimate question. But the thing is, it's a filler definition that is RG time dependent. And if you look at the point of view that was actually advocated by Wegener as early as 1974, those generates RG flow. And Wegener had other conditions to like see the RG flow here. But those people, I chose them. There's a whole literature on that stuff. I chose them because they actually show that if you just need the RG time dependent filler definition to generate the whole RG flow. And you can actually get the exact RG flow Wilson, Wegener, Polshinsky with that thing. So since we have RG time dependent filler definition, then there's an RG flow. It's the same. If you were to tell me, yeah, but that doesn't work because, you know, it's a filter definition. I can tell you that QCD is the RG time dependent filter definition, so there wouldn't be flow. It wouldn't be RG flow there. But there's something different. It's like the beta functions operators are actually redundant operators. That's something that doesn't usually happen in normal RG flows. So you can again ask, okay, are you sure that it's Scandrian trajectories or a fixed point? But the point is, they're redundant operators, and the wave function normalization operators are also redundant operators, and they don't like screw up your flow. And that's very important, actually, that the beta functions operators are redundant operators, as we'll see later, because if they were not, then I wouldn't be able to get scale invariance. So that's the first part of, do you get scale invariant trajectories, or do you get fixed point? And I say that, yes, we get non-trivial RG flows. So there are implications. And the first one is implication for the A theorem. So I'll use the most stringent definition of gradient flow. The gradient flow is what it says. It says like the beta functions is given by the derivative of one function here that is sometimes called the potential, and a positive definite metric here. And sometimes people use another definition where that metric is not necessarily positive definite. So if it's not necessarily positive definite, the argument doesn't go through exactly. So it leaves some room here. But if you have this, then you can see that the potential, the C function there, is a monotonically decreasing function along the RG flow, because its derivative is given by this. And since it's positive definite, then the only place where it's equal to zero is when the beta functions are equal to zero. So if you have a scalar trajectory, then you cannot have a gradient flow, because you stay at the same place, basically. The theory is still the same, but the C function should decrease, but doesn't decrease. It stays constant. So you cannot have gradient flow. And it's also the other way around. If I have gradient flow, so if the theory has a gradient flow in it and the metric here is positive definite, then I cannot have a current behavior. So there are implications here. And we don't know in four dimensions, I must say right now. We don't know yet if we have an example or not in four dimensions. So maybe that's still OK in four dimensions. And if you look at those people, they define the like three versions of the A theorem, if you want. Obviously, the RG flow should be seen as an irreversible process of integrating out the degrees of freedom, the massive one. So you can see it as a measure of the number of masses of degrees of freedom. And then if you have recurrent behavior, it's kind of OK. You still flow, but you don't you kind of integrate stuff, but you don't integrate anything at the same time. So it's still consistent, but it's a bit weird looking at it that way. So what happens? They have three versions of the A theorem. And the first one that says that only the value of the potential, the C function, in the R is smaller than the one, the UV, nothing happens to it. The second one says that it has to be a monotonically decreasing function. That's a stronger version. This one, you have to change it and include the fact that it's zero for scalar invariant theories, not just for conformal invariants. And the last one is the strongest one, is RG flows. But then you have to, this one goes away if you find examples of scale without conformal invariants. So that's very interesting. It's not, now it's not just a question of asking, OK, can you get scale without conformal invariants and quantum field theories with interactions? It's really more related to all that. And I think it's way more interesting to look at it that way now. It was already interesting, but now you can get recurrent behavior. You can like screw up the A theorem, or at least like a very one version of it. So there's interesting physics here. And what is weird is it's all quantum field theory, and nobody's seen that. OK, so there are a bunch of things you can check. And following Coleman again, because Coleman did everything, you can check like dilatation generators. And what the Coleman and Jackie showed is that dilatation generators do not generate dilatations in non-scalar invariant quantum field theories. And they looked at it at lowest order. They look at quantum anomalies, and you get the anomalous dimension here appearing in some Wöhler entities. And they showed that it's possible to absorb them into the redefinition of the scale dimensions of the fields, and then you can preserve scalar invariants that way. But if you keep going on, then the beta functions appear, and then it's not possible to absorb them, and you break scalar invariants. So that's what they showed. And basically, that's related to the RG flow. But what happens in our case? Like, in scalar invariant quantum field theories, you should be able to have dilatation generators that generate dilatations. So what you have to look at, you have to look at the beta function. That was a problem before. Now, if you look at the beta function, it has both vertex correction and wave function normalization contributions. But its form is very specific. So let me go back to what I had before. If you look at the beta functions here, they're linear in the lambdas and linear in the y's. And if you look at those here, it's like having zero here and those terms only. It's not really that, but what you get, you just get the part that is kind of the same than the anomalous dimension. So the vertex correction kind of disappears. And now you can see why you're going to be able to get dilatation generators that generate dilatations, because now, the part that is the vertex correction, you can rewrite it as a part that is equivalent to the wave function normalization. And it's just because they're redundant operators. So that was very important that they are redundant operators. You can do that. So now you can also absorb the beta function into the redefinition of the scale dimension of the fields. And you can get scale. You can preserve scale invariants. So an easy way to see that is look at the Wöhler entity for the effective action. So if you look at, that's the Cannon's symmetric equation, basically. You have the scale, so here it's kind of the RG flow parameter. And then I have the beta function part and the anomalous dimension part. Just do it for some random fields here to make it simpler. In non-scalar invariant quantum field theories, you can absorb this bit in the dimension of the fields, but you cannot absorb this bit. So you don't get scale invariant, bad dilatation generators that generate dilatations. And CFTs, it's pretty easy. This one, you can absorb it again, but this one is vanishing, so you don't have this part, everything is fine. What is different is non-conformal scale invariant quantum field theories. I have this bit, but since it's linear in the fields, and everything is homogeneous, I can just act on that, and then I can see that it's the same thing acting with Q on the lambdas or P's on the Y's. And then I get something like this instead on a scale invariant trajectory, and then I see that I can absorb both. So I do get dilatation generators that generate dilatation. And again, it was very important that the beta functions operator were redundant operators. And now we can look at everything from the beginning again. And you can look at the beta functions on scale invariant trajectories. And you ask yourself, OK, there's some quantum mechanical generation of the scale dimensions. Where did that come from? That has to be exactly what you need to get the good varial current and get the conserved dilatation current. So where does that come from? You have to start with the augmented Poincaré algebra, so the one with the extra dilatation current, coming by this. And then you act on fields, usual definitions. One thing important to notice here, since I don't have the special conformal transformation generator, then I don't have a notion of primary fields. But I still have the notion of descendant, because I can still act with Q, with P, sorry. So I can go up with the momentum generator, but I can go down with the special conformal transformation generator. So I kind of have like half a module if you want to go up, but you cannot go down. So that's one big difference with conformal field theories. And then if you use the dilatation current and you just the dilatation chart and you just apply it to the fundamental fields, you get at the classical level, you get the usual thing plus the bit coming from the varial current. So how does the theory know that it has to be scale invariant? But it's simple. That bit is actually generated by the beta function. So that's pretty cool. You have the theory that generates everything that to tell you that, OK, I'm scale invariant. I'm not conformal, but I'm scale invariant. And at the quantum mechanical level, when you take everything into account, you have scaling dimensions given by this. So that's for a scalar field, the usual one plus the anomalous dimension plus the extra contribution coming from the varial current. And then for the fermion field, you have something like this here. I'm not saying that those should be seen as like very nice, well-defined scaling dimensions, because that's Hermitian, but that's not Hermitian, so it doesn't make much sense to try to diagonalize that thing. It's possible because when you add the symmetric and anti-symmetric matrices together, it's possible you get a matrix that you cannot diagonalize. But still, from the dilatation current and dilatation charge that we have, that's what you would see from it. OK, so again, are you sure you get scale invariant trajectories? Or are they scale invariant fixed points? The point is, the beta functions are basically like anomalous dimensions. So people told us that, and that's true. They're basically like anomalous dimensions in this case. So why can't you just shift them away into the anomalous dimension and get something that you don't have beta functions, you just have everything in the anomalous dimension. That's a good point. That's a valid point. But then if you want to shift something from the beta function, you have to use a scheme change. That's the only thing that makes sense. And if you do that and you manage to do it, then you get a non-conformal scale invariant quantum field theory with traces energy momentum tensor. And that goes against the whole thing that we said at the beginning. We said that if you want, bam. We started with the assumption that the theory would be scale invariant only if the trace of the energy momentum tensor is the divergence of a local operator. So that you cannot do that. If it were also possible, then since it's a global shift, that would change conformal fixed point to conformal trajectories. So I don't think you want to do that either. The best thing is to keep the conformal fixed points as fixed points, the scale invariant trajectories as recurrent behavior, and then everything is consistent. OK. And now you can ask some simple questions. For example, what do you get for two-point functions, three-point functions for fields? So here I'm just going to concentrate on scalar fields. And the two-point function is given by this. But if you compare to conformal field theory, here you can have different scaling dimensions. In conformal field theory, that's non-zero only when the scaling dimensions are the same, but in scalar elementary theories, it doesn't have to be. If you look at the three-point function, it's given by this, and there's a sum here. The big difference between conformal field theory and scalar elementary theories is, in conformal field theories, these exponents are fixed. And basically, like the extra constraint you get here and there is by applying the special conformal transformation on those and checking both sides, how they transform, and just making them consistent. That was what people knew from before, but now one thing you can do, since we know how everything transforms with respect to the new dilatation charge, you can just like apply the dilatation charge on that one, and then you can see that the most general form you get is something like this. And again, like you see the oscillations there. If the scaling dimension has to have, if the scaling dimension ends up having an imaginary eigenvalue. So if you have an imaginary eigenvalue, which would be possible in the strongly coupled case, then that's going to oscillate too. So you would get the usual, if you want, scaling dependence. So it goes down with the good powers of the dimensions here. But on top of it, you will have oscillation. So you get something like this. So that was not expected. But that also goes, that's also consistent with the trajectory there. Okay, so now that I talked about the physics, are there examples of that or not? Would be interesting to find some. So we'll look at Polshinsky first and then Dorogonin and Rychkov after. So Polshinsky in his paper, he checked that at one loop you have to have scalar invariance. You have to have conformal invariance if you have scalar invariance. So I can rewrite the beta functions on the scalar invariant trajectory into this form. So here I'm just writing it in a shortcut because those equations would be horrible. And if you start with only real scalar fields, so I'm only going to have this equation here, then you can check that that Q times the beta at one loop is equal to zero. That means that since beta is equal to Q, that means Q squared is equal to zero. And then beta is equal to Q, so beta is equal to zero, so scalar implies conformal invariance. And much later, in 2009, Dorogonin and Rychkov did the same thing, but they added vial fermions. And there they checked that P star on beta for the beta y basically is equal to zero. So that means that P times P star is equal to zero, then beta is equal to zero. And using that knowledge, you can look that Q on beta lambda is equal to zero when you do that. So again, you get scalar invariance and implied conformal invariance. So you cannot get anything at one loop. What we did, we started looking at two loops. If you have just real scalar fields, then you do the same thing, and you see that it's equal to zero again, so scalar plus conformal invariance. If you have one real scalar field and a bunch of vial fermions, then like Q is obviously equal to zero because the anti-symmetric one-by-one matrix is zero. You can check P star times beta, and again, you get equal to zero, so P is equal to zero, so I get scalar plus conformal invariance. But if you start introducing a bunch of real fields and a bunch of vial fermions, then P star times beta is not equal to zero, and then you have to do a case-by-case analysis. But what that means that scale invariance does not necessarily imply conformal invariance. So it seems like it's possible to get scale invariant trajectories that are not conformal invariant. The obstruction in that case comes from terms in the beta function of this type, those two. So that's a shortcut, like there are a bunch of indices here, but that's just to make it simpler. And it's also the obstruction that Wallace and Zia in 1975 pointed out for the gradient flow interpretation. Because that term here in the beta function for the Yukawa is two loop. This one is two loop too. If you want to write them, I guess I have chalk somewhere. Oh. Sorry. If you want to write them as terms in a C function, CG, then the y cube one would be something like y4 lambda. So when I take dy, I get y cube lambda. But being two loops, that means it's something like this with that power. But then if I do d lambda on it, I get y4 over 16 pi squared. But that's a term that appears at one loop in the beta function for lambda. So that doesn't work here with the exponent. And there's a way out of that by changing the metric, the positive definite metric. So it might be possible to get something that makes sense at two loops, but it's not sure of that. So just to give you an idea of how that works, conformal field theory fixed point would be stable with respect to higher order correction. So it's basically something like this. You get the beta function in red here, and then you add an extra loop term, and it's going to move it around, but you still have the zero. While in our case, since it's zero at one loop, but then it might not be zero at two loops, it has to be something like this. So you get close, you get to zero, but then you add the extra correction, and then you move around, and you lose the fixed point. So it's kind of unstable with respect to higher order corrections, I mean the conformal fixed point, but not the scan invariant one. So a systematic approach to look for such examples is to go at weak coupling, so you can do something. And you look at the beta functions, and you try to cancel terms at one loop order, and then like the two loops they get in, etc. So the only one that I'll cancel with one and two loops is the term for the gauge coupling, like in Banzhaf. And that tells me which power I'm going to have here. So you just choose the Banzhaf such that I get an epsilon g cube, then plus g5, and then I can cancel those two terms. And then all the other ones would cancel appropriately if you choose the good powers here. And for q and p, you have to go to n equal 2 because we know that n equal 1, there's scalar plus conformal invariance. You can also do that in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, and obviously like the epsilon would be the epsilon here. So I basically said all that. So once that's done, you can go and look for solutions. But one thing that at first we thought we were good, but then after that we realized we're not okay, is related to scheme dependence of the beta function. So if I have only one coupling, then like I can do a scheme change of this form, and the beta function, the first scheme and the second scheme are given by something like this, and I can check that those are related. So the first two terms are the same, but the third one is not. And it's actually possible to put the third, the fourth, and all the other ones equal to zero. That was shown by Gross for one coupling constant. That's very nice, and then that means you can do high precision numerical analysis. But you just have one coupling, and if you go to that scheme, it's just one equation. It's basically a cubic equation, so I can just solve it. So it's not useful at all. And we thought you can do the same thing for more coupling. So then you could do numerical analysis because it's pretty horrible. Just to tell you, the number of couplings grow up for the scalar, the quartic couplings, it goes up like ns to the fourth. And for the Yukawas, it goes up like ns times nf squared. So it doesn't take too long. You put like three scalars there, and you already have something like, I don't remember, it's like it's 7 times 6 times 4 times 5. And that's 6 times 5 times 4, yeah. So now, like, you can check, okay, I have more than one coupling, and I want to do a scheme change. What I get this. And the only thing that is true is, like, the first one is the same, the first term in the beta function, but not the other ones. And that was folklore. We didn't know about it. And actually, Collins, again, shows that in his book. So it's even textbook stuff, but we didn't know about it. What is weird is like you can cancel some of the two loop terms, but you cannot cancel all of them. So your fixed point is still well defined, your scan invariant trajectory is still well defined. But now, since I cannot cancel all the third, fourth, and fifth loop corrections, then I cannot do numerical analysis, like high precision numerical analysis, and you're basically stuck. So it doesn't take too long before it's pretty difficult to do any work there. So examples, physical examples in four dimensions, we haven't found one yet. And the main problem, it's very difficult just to generate the beta functions. So on Mathematica, we did it for simple models, and some of them, like this one, for example, I think it took, after 1 month, the Mathematica just crashed, so we tried something else and managed to make it work with something else. But just to tell you, like Mathematica just crashed with that simple model, SU2. With two real scalar fields and two active flavors of Weyl fermions. By active, I mean those have Yukawas, but Yeah, those have Yukawas, and then I introduce a bunch of like other extra val fermions that aren't that don't have Yukawas, and then those are just there to make my Banks X fix point appear. And in that example, we managed to see that actually there's something that looks right, but it's unbounded from below the scalar potential. And if you look at it, we just found it numerically, and then we investigated a bit more. And the question was, at first, was, is it trustworthy? We're not sure. And looking at it carefully, it's actually, it's non-zero, the Q and the P, if you want, but it's at three loop order that it starts. So it's not before we add the three loop contribution to the beta function that it would be able to tell if we have a real four-dimensional example on that. And one little problem is unbounded from below. At first, that was our real problem, but then when we realized the scheme dependent stuff, we realized that's not that big a problem. This one is bigger. And we tried to get to more difficult models, but then like would take 2 months to crash Mathematica instead. And trying to, after just generating the beta functions, then after that you have to solve it. So you try to solve the model, and we couldn't find it, like Mathematica couldn't find any solutions. So the problem is either it's related to, it's something deeper. There's like at two loops, it's not possible to have scale without conformal invariance. That's possible. Either it's just because the model is too simple, or yeah, it's one or the other basically. But the thing is, we tried more difficult models, we cannot solve them. So we realized that actually the best thing to do is to go to three loop with a bit of functions, and they're not found anywhere, they're not written anywhere. And it's really a pain in the ass to try to compute the beta functions at three loop in the most general normalized field theory. We started it. We thought it would take forever. Like first time I gave that talk, I said it's going to take 5 years before we have that done, because the people who did that in the 80s were Jack and Osborne, and also Machacek and Wong. And if you look at the first paper and the last paper, there's like 5 years difference. So we thought like it's going to take 5 years for us to do that. But actually, what we did, we managed to generate the most general beta functions without computing the coefficients. And then we tried, we look at what are the diagrams that would contribute to the, basically the virial current would give me a non-zero virial current. So once you compute all those terms, if you see that they cancel, then okay, I'll believe in, I'll say you don't have scale without conformal invariance in four dimensions. But if they don't cancel, then we have an example at three loop. So we're trying to do that shortcut right now, and we dropped from 250 diagrams to 16. So there are only 16 that contribute to Q. So it shouldn't be too bad. Still, it's difficult to do three loop diagrams, but it shouldn't be too bad. Anyways, we have on physical examples in 4-epsilon dimensions, and it's simply like two real scalars and one Dirac field. What Dirac fermion, and there you have limit cycles, and it's bounded from below. You see the couplings, like they rotate, everything is pretty nice. But we don't know unless you go to the epsilon equal one limit, and you have no clue about the universality class. And that implies some kind of like lattice computation, so we don't know if they make sense on that. But at least like it means that it kind of tells us that it's possible that you get something. So that's interesting, and we'll try to push for the three loop case. And if it doesn't work, then we just, okay, scale implies conformal invariance. But if it does, then that's nice. So the physics of non-conformal scale invariant quantum field theories is actually less constrained than CFTs. So you would expect a lot of examples, but they're not known. And what is nice, like the beta function is like the NMS dimension. So you can do everything I said before. You get dilatation generators that generate dilatation. And that leads to very rare RG flows that people didn't expect before. Actually, I was looking at other papers recently, and one pretty old also. They look at the relation between recurrent behaviors and a possible C function. And they argue that it's possible to have a C function that makes sense anyways there. I'm not sure if it's possible in our case, but if it is, then that'd be cool still. And they also argue about chaotic behavior, so it might be possible to get chaotic behavior in our case too. That would be nice to see. But like what I implies for the most stringent version of the Ethereum, that means that it's violated because it cannot be gradient flow. And there are a bunch of things you can do there because nobody's worked on scalability theories that are not conformal. And one thing we checked is phenomenological applications. We did like George I. Instead of coupling the standard model to like a conformal field theory, we coupled it to a non-conformal scalability trajectory. And then you can get on particle physics that is basically cyclic. So one thing you can do, you can get cross sections. I don't know. Let's say electrons to electrons, and then at high energy, they start going to electrons, and then as you increase the energy, they go to muons, and then tau taus, and then they go back to electrons. So you can get like cool stuff here. And really, like, the most important thing is to look at higher order and try to make it work. If it doesn't, then there's a hate theorem, and I believe in all that. I'll work on it. But if it does, then I keep working on scale without conformal invariants. OK, thanks for that. I think it's more related to which regularization scheme you can use and which one you can't. So you know, only for simple Ward identities, for like U1 QED, for example, some regularization schemes don't work. So that you get basically Z1 is different than Z2. And then you go to another regularization scheme and you get them equal. And I think it's something like that here. You want to use one that will preserve as much of the classical symmetry that you have. Here would be, I guess, since there are no real RG cutoff, but you still have the RG scale, it's like moving in RG scale. Like the randomization scale, sorry, you still have that one, so you can move, you move on this one. Everything, because we started with the energy momentum tensor.
So if you have examples of non-relativistic situations, it's like behavior
like the Efimov state, or yeah. It seems like it could be related, but we don't know exactly how. We didn't look at it yet. But in one thing, we asked some condensed matter people, and they told us that there they have cycles, but they have discrete scale invariants. So only when you go back to the same point, you get scale invariance if you want. While in our case, we have a constant current on whole trajectory, and you don't even have to go back to the same point. It's possible you never go back to it if you have ergodicity there. So, for example, if you have a model with, I think, 4 scalars, and all the q's are not zero, but the p's are zero, then you can get 2 different eigenvalues. And if the ratio is not a rational number, then you'll never go back to the point you were at first. So you're stuck in kind of a bend. You don't go out of the bend, but you never go back to the same point. In their case, it's really you're a cycle, so like the 4 minus epsilon case. We still don't know, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty amazing that when we generated the whole thing, we had 252 diagrams, I think. Then we're, ah, come on, we don't have to compute all that. And then if you follow that systematic approach, only the first term, first term in the expansion would be a difficult equation to solve. It's a quadratic equation. Then after that, they're all linear. So once you found like a good first point, then you can just plug in and go through. So what we did, that's what we did, and then we went to the three loop term and then just check which contributions, like which diagram contribute to the Q or the P in that case. And then we know we just have to compute those. One thing we hoped was that at three loop, you can start having irrational numbers, actually transcendental. I don't think they're proven transcendental, but they are almost transcendental. You can get zeta 3 there. And we hope that we would have only one diagram with zeta 3 and all the other ones without. Since everything is not transcendental otherwise, then we would be sure you cannot cancel that. So we would be sure there's a Skinnerian trajectory that's not conformal. But the problem is the zeta 3 doesn't appear in the contribution to Q. So it's still possible to cancel. But that seemed to imply that if they cancel, they have to cancel to every possible solution that could be scale invariant but not conformal invariant. So there's something very deep. If scale implies conformal invariance, there's something very deep in the form of the beta function.
Thanks.